Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. The New York Times 1619 Project has engendered a backlash among conservatives. 400 years after the arrival of the first enslaved Africans, how does the legacy of slavery fit into our historical memory? Plus, as the NFL marks its 100th anniversary, controversy continues to surround the league. Colin Kaepernick remains unemployed 3 years after he began his kneeling protest, and a deal with hip-hop mogul Jay-Z has raised eyebrows rather than hopes about the league's commitment to addressing a history of racial discrimination. WIPR's Milton Kent joins us for a conversation about how the dynamics of race and power are playing out off the field. Midday Culture Connections starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Park. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Sherry, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you.
So today we're going to take up a couple of topics that have been in the news lately. In a little bit, we'll talk about the New York Times 1619 Project. While many have applauded the Times and the editor of the series, Nicole Hannah-Jones, some conservatives have complained about the series, saying that it delegitimizes America. So we'll talk about that later in the program. But first, rap mogul Jay-Z has entered into a partnership with the National Football League, and there are plenty of folks who have taken umbrage about that. What do you all think about Jay-Z and the National Football League and this partnership that was announced just a couple of weeks ago? Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And it looks like we are also streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Joining us on the line from his office at Morgan State University is our good friend Milton Kent. He's the host of Sports at Large here on WYPR, and he's a member of the faculty in the School of Global Journalism and Communication at Morgan. Hey, Milton, how you doing?
Hello there, Tom, and hello, Sherry.
Hi there.
Hi there.
So, Sherry, let me start with you. What's your reaction to this partnership, so-called, between Jay-Z and the NFL?
Well, I guess I would have to describe myself as suspicious and skeptical. I mean, as certainly Milton and other people have written, a year ago he was criticizing the NFL, particularly about the Colin Kaepernick and treatment of players. And I know we're going to talk about this, but he says we're now beyond kneeling. And I would suggest that maybe not, and maybe buying into the franchise, which is certainly the great hope, may not be the remedy that we seek.
And before we go to you, Milton, I want to play a little clip from a press conference that Mr. Carter, Jay-Z, that's his stage name. I guess his name is Sean Carter in real life. This is an appearance that he made with Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the National Football League, on the 14th of August, talking about this collaboration between his company, Roc Nation, and the NFL.
I think that we forget that Colin's whole thing was to bring attention to social injustice, correct? So in that case, right, this is a success, right? This is the next thing, right? Because there's two parts of protesting. You go outside and you protest, and then the company or the individual say, I hear you. What do we do next, right? So for me it was like action, actionable item. What are we going to do with it? Like, everyone heard, and we hear what you're saying, and everybody know, I agree with what you're saying. So what are we going to do? Reach millions and millions of people, or we get stuck on Colin not having a job?
So, Milton, what do you think? Are we just stuck on Colin not having a job?
You know, it's interesting. This topic came up. It's come up a couple times. It came up in my class last week, and we had a young man who's visiting the country from England. He's a student at Oxford University, and he's actually doing a documentary, or in the process of researching a documentary, on black athletes and their social activity. And my class is about seven or eight of sports. It's a sports writing class. And what I found was that these things, as many things do these days, tend to break down along generational lines. I tend to think, you know, as someone who's older, my thought is that, just in the simplistic perhaps, I just feel as though Jay-Z sort of stepped over Colin Kaepernick on the way to making a buck, as Sherry suggested, maybe even someday being an owner. My students, however, who are dramatically younger, much younger, sort of look to the bottom line, that if, in fact, he does someday become an owner, or he opens the door to ownership, and that in turn opens the door to more black general managers, coaches, quarterbacks, this is a good thing. I'm not sure that I can necessarily see, I get it, I see it, but I don't know that I necessarily agree with it. And all you have to do is just look at the rosters just in the last couple weeks, as there's been so much turnover. Perfect example. The Jacksonville Jaguars saw their starting quarterback, Nick Foles, get injured on opening day. He broke his collarbone. He's going to be out by significant weeks. They have a rookie who was the backup. They brought in a guy who I've never heard of to be this rookie's backup. So I'm thinking, here's Colin Kaepernick, who was within a play of winning the Super Bowl, indeed the most recent Super Bowl the Ravens played in, and he can't get a sniff. And I don't understand that. I still don't get it.
Yeah, and he's Mr. Kaepernick has been posting YouTube videos saying he gets up every morning at 5 a.m. and he goes and he works out and he's ready to go and he's looking for an audition. He's looking for an opportunity to try out for a team. He did settle, evidently, with the NFL for an undisclosed amount that people have guessed is somewhere south of $10 million for which appears to indicate the NFL accepting culpability for essentially blacklisting him in the league. But Sherry, is this the only way for Jay-Z to get himself into a position to be an owner in the NFL? It seems like there's more than one route to that goal.
Well, I mean, the conversation that we're not having is, what does it mean to be an owner, and what is the structure of owning something that involves human beings, and the draft and trading people, and the fact that owners have been largely white and male until pretty recently. And so that whole system of hierarchy has been very difficult to crack. But let's not forget that what Colin Kaepernick was protesting was police brutality. And that seems to have been shoved out of the way as we talk about a vague social injustice that somehow an economic remedy will address. And it's interesting, Milton, that you spoke to age. And yes, I'm older than you. And I remember when Jesse Jackson got a Pepsi franchise and suddenly he didn't protest and boycott quite so much. And it smacks of that. And while I believe in the strength of art to create conversations, I'm not sure. And I mean, one of the things that they're doing now is selling T-shirts and including other artists to sing songs about the NFL. I'm not quite sure that leads to social justice.
Yeah, Milton, what's your understanding actually as to what Roc Nation is going to do? We've heard talk about Jay-Z helping the league with its social justice initiatives. Since when does the National Football League even have social justice initiatives?
Well, that's a very good question, Tom. In the immediate sense, his participation, Jay-Z's participation, is to serve as a facilitator or sort of like a talent scout, if you will, for big events that the league has where there's going to be entertainment. So, for instance, on opening night, there was some kind of concert or something with some acts. And I don't remember the names, but he, I guess, helped sign off on those folks or helped to bring those in. I assume for Thanksgiving Day, which is the sort of the next big date on the league calendar, there'll be these concerts in Detroit and Dallas and whatever city the third game will be played in, and he'll be sort of facilitator for that. The big kahuna, so to speak, will be come Super Bowl. So theoretically, he will be the person who will help them bring in Super Bowl acts.
And a lot of acts have turned down the Super Bowl.
Including, I thought at one point he did.
He did.
His wife did. I know his wife, Beyonce, has performed there at the Super Bowl. But my understanding was that he either did turn down or encouraged others to turn down Super Bowl invitations for just this reason.
He rapped about it, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, one man's hypocrisy, I suppose, is another man's paycheck. I don't know.
Now, but what about his point? What about his point, which is that, okay, the protest has taken place. The outcome of the protest for Colin Kaepernick might be bad for him, but it's not bad. It's not bad enough to move forward and to try to, you know, affect positive change moving forward. At some point, you got to go to step two. What do you make of that argument?
Not much. I mean, I think as long as Colin Kaepernick is still looking for a job, I just don't see how this sits so well. I mean, and you know, maybe you don't necessarily have to stand on top of boardroom tables and, you know, jump and scream until you're blue in the face, but I just don't think you do this. It's just not a good look.
So this is throwing Kaepernick under the bus.
Yeah, I that's just my impression.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But and I know, you know, at some point we all have to move on. But I think until Kaepernick himself says, "I retired and I'm done," you know, I've given up. And you know, the other thing that makes this a not so neat fit is Kaepernick is not. It would be one thing, I suppose, if Kaepernick were, let's say, a Tom Brady or Drew Brees and had just gaudy stats that just demanded that he be signed. Kaepernick is probably a little above average, a little above mediocre. He's probably, dare I say, in the Joe Flacco category. He's not a great quarterback. He's a good quarterback, occasionally very good. As I mentioned before, he took the 49ers to one play of winning the Super Bowl that they lost to the Ravens. But it's not that, I guess to this point, 32 clubs have made the decision that we can get by without him. And so they have.
And that with him would be buying a whole bunch of trouble.
Well, that too. Let's not kid ourselves. I mean, they would be asking for long protest lines in this day and age that really can't be ignored. And you know, dare I say, many, if not most, of the folks that we're talking about who own these clubs probably hold political positions that are diametrically opposed to Colin Kaepernick. And football is the one place where you can, you know, we had this discussion in my class about why is it that NBA players and WNBA players have been so forthcoming, so outspoken, with very little in the way of punishment.
With some encouragement.
With encouragement, indeed. Whereas with the NFL, it's been quite the opposite. And it's you have to say, I mean, many of these folks, I mean, let's not kid, you know, President Trump's ambassador to England is the owner of the New York Jets. Seven or eight NFL owners have given $1 million to either President Trump or Republican candidates. So, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't take much speculation to figure out where they are politically, but they seem to be making a business decision, and we've talked about this on the show a lot, you know, that it's just not good for business to have Colin Kaepernick suit up in your team's uniform. But at what point is, in fact, is Milton's point correct? Do you agree with that, Sherry, that Colin Kaepernick has to quit before it's time to go on to step two, which coincidentally is also going to be enriching Jay-Z?
Well, let's look at this from a strategy point. The point of kneeling is to call attention to a problem. It's like a rally or, dare I say, a sit-in, which went on for years. And there are still players kneeling. So he's not only stepping past Colin, he's stepping past people who are in the middle of the game, whose platform this is, and bringing someone from the outside and stepping over them. And I think that is problematic when there are people who are still protesting. It buys them, it buys the owners, I mean, we have a black person in our camp. It buys them, in many camps, an excuse or a way to move away from being called racist. And it buys them permission to keep doing what they're doing.
That work, though? Does it? I mean, this seems to me to be like, you know, that famous incident in the Trump campaign in 2016 where he's at the airport hangar and there's one African-American in the crowd of, you know, 10,000 people. He says, there's my African-American. I mean, does embracing Jay-Z really get the NFL off the hook, particularly with their African-American fan base?
Not with his African-American fan base. I mean, last year, I think there were Nike shirts with Colin Kaepernick were a very heavy seller for Christmas. It's more like that African-American man who keeps showing up behind Trump at the rallies, who's there day after day after day, that does buy them some space there. So it's not a one-time thing. And that's what the NFL immediately did. It's saying, you know, we're embracing Jay-Z and we're going to move forward when it's not really moving forward.
And Milton, what about the relationship between Shaquille O'Neal and Papa John's Pizza? Mike Fletcher, our good friend, wrote about this in The Undefeated. He has joined the board of Papa John's Pizza. He has signed a deal to be an ambassador, and he has purchased several Papa John's franchises. Of course, we had all sorts of problems with Papa John's. The owner, the founder of Papa John's, a man named John Schnatter, I guess is his name, late 2017, he blamed a slump in the sales of Papa John's pizzas as what he saw as the NFL's mishandling of the Kaepernick-inspired protests and stuff. So Papa John seems to be trying to do the same thing the NFL is doing, sort of hide behind a famous black figure. What do you make of that?
I have to admit, Tom, I was stunned. I was watching football over the weekend and again last night, and it's gone beyond just like him. You know, he's very visible. Shaquille O'Neal is. He's, I guess, becoming almost as visible for the pizza thing as he is for the insurance thing, the auto insurance thing. He's he allowed himself to be a corporate symbol, a commercial symbol.
$8.25 million deal with Papa John's to be the ambassador. By the way, he's also serving on the board. That makes the Healthy Holly thing look like nothing. I don't get that. How you can be paid $8 million by a board of directors on which you serve? But hey, that's a topic for a different day.
Well,
I'm sorry,
sure. It's a little troubling. It's a little troubling because I do like, and the interesting thing about Shaquille O'Neal is that he sort of violates or he runs counter to the prospect the axiom that we hate Goliath. I don't know very many people who don't like Shaquille O'Neal. He's very affable. He comes across as much as a 7-foot, 350-pound man can, as down to earth or approachable. So I guess in a certain sense you could say that he's being used in the same way that Jay-Z is.
Now, he would contend, or at least he's contended in his public comments, that he's doing this in an effort to diversify the Papa John's board. That when he had a conversation with Schnatter, he said, you know, I'll be a triple threat, but that has to include my being on the board because you have very little, if any, representation of people of color on your board of directors.
I'll just say this. I'd like to see the other members of the board. If there are other men or women, you know, African American women, men or women, or people of color who are on that board, then I guess my argument would dissipate largely. But I wonder about that.
Milton, do you remember about 10 years ago when Shaquille was on the cover of, I think it was Forbes, and they were lauding how well he had handled his money and that he was smarter and richer than anybody knew? I thought about that because there has been an embracing of him as as a smart jock by the business establishment way before this. And I wonder if, in a way, we're seeing the result of that rather than it's being a shocking new development.
I think you're probably right, and I've read those stories too. He's this generation's Magic Johnson in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
Magic is the example of the athlete who didn't squander his money and, in fact, turned through corporate auspices, turned a few million dollars into many millions. And I suspect that's what Shaquille is doing here now. There's a different way, I suppose, of doing it. I guess as someone who used to have heavily partaken in fast food pizza, I'm a little disappointed. There are other places he could have gone, I suppose, but he's using an example, and I guess in the same way that Jay-Z's using the NFL, if somebody's got a problem, they're probably the person that you want to go to first.
Or the other way around, those are the people who are going to seek out African-American spokespeople and partners because they need it to clean up their mistakes.
Point noted.
Race.
Yeah. And, of course, anybody who watched the Ravens game on Sunday and saw Ryan Fitzpatrick starting for the eighth team that he has now been hired by, and you saw how that worked out, you got to wonder, there's Colin Kaepernick working out in San Francisco ready to play. All right, Milton Kent, we appreciate it as always, sir. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Milton Kent is the host of Sports at Large here on WYPR and a member of the faculty at Morgan State University. Dr. Sherry Parks joins me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. When we return, we'll examine the arguments that some conservatives are making against the New York Times 1619 Project, which examines the legacy of slavery 400 years after the first enslaved Africans were brought to our shores. Nicole Hannah-Jones, the director of this expansive project, says it's an attempt to set the record straight about slavery. Newt Gingrich calls it brainwashing. Have you read part or all of the 1619 Project that's been published so far? We'd love to hear what you think about it. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page as well. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up tomorrow, it's another edition of Midday on Ethics. We'll be talking about ultra-expensive drugs and how some people are being priced out of life-saving treatment. So why are so many medications prohibitively expensive? Who decides the cost of medication? Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, joins me for a conversation about the ethics of pharmaceutical pricing. And a reminder that on Thursday, Midday will broadcast live from the Enoch Pratt Central Library. Pratt CEO Heidi Daniel and other Pratt staffers will talk about all the new things going on at the Pratt, including the $115 million renovation that is now complete and a host of new initiatives that will accompany the new digs. So you are welcome to join us in the audience for this event at the Pratt. Come to WYPR.org to reserve a free ticket. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with our good friend Dr. Sherry Parks. Last month, the New York Times launched the 1619 Project, a series that marks the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans to arrive in Virginia. It chronicles the history and legacy of slavery in America. The sweeping series, which includes essays, photo essays, and podcasts, has been enthusiastically received across the country. In New York, people lined up to get copies of the Times magazine a couple of weeks ago when the series launched. The Times made 2,000 extra copies available for people without charge. The series has also drawn the ire of many conservatives, some of whom have accused the piece of setting out to delegitimize America. They have suggested that the Times' telling of this fundamental story of the American experiment is fake news. So what do you think? Have you read it or parts of it? Let us know what you think. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and Sherry and I are streaming the conversation we're having here in Studio A on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Sherry, these are related topics, aren't they? You were talking before in the instance of Colin Kaepernick about the issues of ownership, the issues of power. You could have been talking about slavery.
Right. Those structures, there are lots of structures left in the society that recall slavery in some ways. And it's not, I will say this, and then we'll talk about this, that it's not lost in the players. I've known lots of football players, you know, went to school with them, taught them, advised them. And the idea that football is a plantation and that they feel like slaves are farm animals is something that you hear a lot.
Yeah, the buying and selling, the trading, you know, all
right.
That stuff.
Not having control over where you work.
On the other hand, how else would you do it? I mean, if you own a football team, you're going to try to get personnel, and you're going to trade personnel with other people with personnel, I guess. I mean, I suppose Goldman Sachs, you know, doesn't do it that way.
Exactly.
But so should trading in the NFL be abolished?
Well, we're beginning to see agency of athletes in other sports where they can negotiate and have some control, a little bit in football. It would take more work, but it would give them some, I mean, I'm using the word agency in both senses of the word, mm-hmm. Some control over where and how they work, yeah.
What is your impression of, first of all, the 1619 Project as a whole, and secondly, what we've come to now see a great resistance to it on the part of people on the right side of the political spectrum?
I think it's a really important moment, even if you haven't read it symbolically. We have yet, as a country, to turn around and look slavery full in the face and look at it and its role in the United States. I'm going to tell you a quick story about a 12-year-old Sherry at Williamsburg who was standing there in front of a white reenactor. And I said, "Who does the work around here?" And he said, "The servants." And I said, "What year is this? Are we still in Virginia? What year? Who does the work around here?" I just wanted him to say it. I wanted him to say it, you know, in the way you have a daughter. You know what a 12-year-old girl is like. And he began to sweat because he couldn't say it. And finally, someone pulled me away, like, "Leave the poor man alone." And I was very upset because I wanted him to say the truth. And he couldn't. And that's what we're really pushing against, the pun intended, the whitewashing of American history and the role that slavery has played.
A lot's been written about slavery. There's a historical record about slavery. There are scholars of slavery. There's data points aplenty about slavery. Why is it important that the New York Times is taking this up as opposed to the scores of movies and novels and historical works that have been written about this very important piece of American history?
Well, first of all, we have to say that slavery is still very lightly, if at all, treated in the educational system of the United States. I don't know what the textbooks looked like when you were young, but it wasn't there, and it's still not there, or if it's put in a box and treated as a very isolated subject. So it's not part of the common consciousness. And the New York Times, while it is not read by the great country, is really important in terms of the ethos of the country. And one of the really important ideas that has surfaced because of the New York Times series is the role of slavery in the deep, deep roots of the country. The role of slavery as the underbelly of the Enlightenment has led to, and which is actually one of my favorite topics, about how many people wrote and read about how you defend slavery during the period of both the French and the American Enlightenment period. And so that idea, one of the reasons why this is so threatening to conservatives is that slavery is woven through the roots and the foundation of this country in a way that you can't explain away once you look at it.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, who is a MacArthur Fellow mm-hmm. for her work on race, is the animating force behind this. She suggested this to the Times editorial board back in January to acknowledge the 400th anniversary, which happened a week or so ago in August. And she says it's an attempt to set the record straight. It's a big record. Now, let's dig down a little deeper about what straightening needs to be done with the record here.
Well, I mean, and actually, we should not suggest that the New York Times did or even could have the complete record. I mean, it's been criticized because it's a victim story. There are very few heroic Black people who overcame the circumstances of slavery or whatever, because that's not the narrative that they're trying to correct. And we have not recognized the way slavery touches almost everything in American culture today. I mean, the way Midwestern states are configured is because of slavery. You and I had to go back and check. You know, we did a piece with Caitlin Rosenthal on modern day accounting practices mm-hmm. and slavery. And so that is the thing, and what slavery was like. I mean, how brutal it was, but how important it was to the economy at the time and still is.
The fact that one of the central tenets of this is that all of the writers in this series had to be Black. Almost all of them are Black. And the fact that Ms. Jones makes the argument that Black Americans compelled the nation to move more toward an actual democracy than the founders did.
Well,
that's the central narrative.
Yeah,
and that's the
yeah.
thing that was really compelling to me, that if you think about what actually worked in terms of strategery, as President Bush would say, the African American struggle for civil rights has moved the country closer to this ideal of democracy and each person in America, you know, having the right to the liberty and life and the pursuit of happiness.
You've heard me say that African Americans occupy a place in the morals of this society that's bigger than our numbers. And this is one of the reasons, is that you do have this grand contradiction of the American Revolution and the Enlightenment period that, I mean, there's no way around it. It's a huge paradox that at the same time you're talking about the equality of people, that you have this gross inequality. And so you have in the American movement, not just the modern civil rights movement, but the action before, this attempt, which has been partially successful, toward correction of that.
Why is it important that the bulk of the writers for this in this series be Black? Because people raise that as an issue, and I think of our mutual friend Taylor Branch, who lives right here in Baltimore, who's written the seminal, what many people consider the seminal work on the history of the civil rights movement, Dr. King. He won the Pulitzer mm-hmm. Prize right, for the first right. volume of that.
And Ira Berlin, who wrote a lot of the history as well. And not to take away from the brilliance of their work and the sympathy that they have for African Americans, those histories have been largely written by white people. And there's a different perspective that comes when you are the descendant of a slave. There are things you pick up on that historians have not picked up on. They're nuances and blood memory. I mean, I talked to a famous historian once, actually on WYPR, and I thanked him for what I said I thought was sacred work. And he said, "What do you mean?"
Sacred work.
Sacred work that pulling up the voices of slaves and giving them a place to speak, which is what he was doing, is important work. And maybe only a white man at that point could have done it. But he didn't. For him, it was a job. And I'm not saying that about Taylor Branch. I mean, we both know him. But for many of people, it is a job as opposed to a calling to honor the names of people who suffered so terribly.
And Ms. Jones makes the point that for so long, the American education system, when it dealt with slavery, if it dealt with slavery in some cases for many generations, but in my generation, when I was a school kid, I remember learning about slavery, but the focus was on the benevolence of the owners, the relationship, you know, that they were part of the family and you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it was definitely a different focus.
Oh, it's not that much different now. As you know, textbooks are written for Texas because they buy so many of them. And so slavery often, and so you put controversial issues in an inset box, and that is actually still the case. Sometimes I saw a textbook where I called it Eloise with Slaves, that if you were the child of a slave owner, grown-ups would have to do what you told them to do. That is a fairly recent text. And so Black parents who have the leisure and the education routinely spend a lot of effort backfilling what is the educational offering around slavery. We just don't know it.
It's Midday Culture Connections. Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Quick break, and when we come back, you are welcome to join us. Our phone number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can ping us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. Before we go to a break, we want to let you know about a local event related to the 1619 Project, the Memorial Episcopal Church, and the Bolton Hills Social Action Task Force are hosting a community conversation about the 1619 Project on Sunday. Panelists include Dr. Christopher Bonner of the University of Maryland, Dr. Rob Helfenbein of Loyola University, and Jenny Williams. She's a doctoral student at Johns Hopkins University. The event begins at noon on Sunday at Memorial Episcopal Church. That's at the corner of Bolton Street and Lafayette Avenue in Bolton Hill. It begins with a brunch that includes a jazz trio and a poetry reading by a popular local poet, Lady Breon. The event is free, but they will take up a collection to support the new Pennsylvania Avenue Arts and Entertainment District. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Park. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's also the author of a terrific book, Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the New York Times 1619 Project. 400 years after the first enslaved Africans were brought to America, we continue to wrestle with the ghosts of our past. Conversations about how the legacy of slavery fits into our history are often fraught with denial, like many of our conversations about race in general. For example, recently a disgruntled tourist made headlines after she left a negative review of a tour of the Whitney Plantation in Wallace, Louisiana. She lamented, quote, "We didn't come to hear a lecture on how the white people treated slaves. We came to get this history of a southern plantation and to get a tour of the house and grounds. The tour guide was so radical about slave treatment, we felt we were being lectured and bashed about the slavery."
So now we're moving into history as entertainment. And there's been a lot of worry about this by a field called public historians, people who worry about the role between history and so now and heritage tourism is a lot of money. And actually a big part of that is African Americans who are now, moving in to hear and learn about their history. There was a quote in one of the articles that you sent where John Works, who was a Jefferson dependent, said, "There is a limit to the appeal of the slavery message." I mean, it's such a calm, that people—
A limit to the appeal.
To the appeal, yeah. And that this is such an unpleasant issue. And actually, there's a book that talks about what happens when you bring in, by Valerie Wilfork, about what happens when you bring slavery into these environments, because it's difficult for African Americans if they don't know that it's going to be there, and many other people don't like it.
In 1995, the Smithsonian was going to do an exhibition about the 50th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the director decided not to do it. The curator of that department said, quote, "Do you want to do an exhibition intended to make veterans feel good, or do you want an exhibition that will lead our visitors to think about the consequences of the atomic bombing in Japan? I don't think we can do both."
Well, in grad school, I actually took a course, and it was an evening course, which was unfortunate, on Hiroshima films. And so I spent a semester having nightmares. So I understand the reaction. It's interesting. We have a local example here with Blacks in Wax.
Gets busloads and busloads of tourists from all across the Eastern Seaboard coming to visit.
And before the museum in D.C., they were showing slavery full in the face, but they had a room with a sign that, you know, warned you that that's what you're about to see so you could choose it. But even they got criticized by people who didn't expect to see it.
So let's talk about some of the criticism that has been heaped on the 1619 Project. There's a conservative commentator named Eric Erickson, who has a big platform. I see him on television all the time. He says that this is done at the hands of opinion writers who profit from stoking and fueling racial grievances. How do you even respond to that?
Well, there are some pieces in the 1619 Project which are not straight history. I mean, and it would be hard to do something that is so emotional without some. I agree that you need writers who help digest this, but that led to an opening that let people say this is about opinion as opposed to history. Now, anybody who knows history or knows historians knows that their particular perspective can change how they write it.
Absolutely. I guess this could apply to almost anything, but in terms of this series, he says that seeing things through racial lenses and keeping racial tension aflame is as bad as what Trump does. So that you should never even look at the universe with a racial equity or a racial lens. That in and of itself is self-defeating.
It's blindness, because that flame has never been extinguished. I mean, it burns. I mean, we were just talking about, you know, Colin Kaepernick, but I mean, many of the structures and policies that have kept African Americans in some of the situations have been put there on purpose.
What do you make of the argument that it's delegitimizing the American experiment, the basic premise of the American?
It exposes the rottenness that was already there.
How does that not then, I'm trying to figure out their argument as well here, how does that not delegitimize what is the word delegitimize valid here, in that if the founders, you know, were they just completely hypocritical in owning slaves?
What do you think I think? Yes.
Of course. But let's think, because I talked to George Will a few weeks ago, and he talks about the Constitution. He says, look, here's the trade-off. The North had to agree to slavery in order to get the Constitution and to get the Declaration. And if they hadn't agreed to slavery, if they had held their ground and, you know, not compromised, we wouldn't have a Constitution. We wouldn't have an American.
Well, you know, and that's interesting, because that argument goes back as far as the French Enlightenment, where, I mean, the Black Code was defended because it was the redemption of the country. It led to the redemption of the country. That slavery is a necessary evil is at best a partial statement, at worst an amoral statement. And both are there. And if we are, and the United States is at an interesting point right now, where we can rest on the propaganda that we've had for the last 400 years, which is not true, or if we are to move into a more mature society, which certainly I think me and lots of other writers think we must, it includes looking at our history full in the face, the way, for instance, Germany has with the Holocaust.
Linda Riddleman, who was on the show yesterday, she's active in the League of Women Voters and also active in the Bolton Hill Community Association. We were talking about Bolton Hill on the Midday in the Neighborhood series yesterday. She sent an email to me this morning talking about the Reverend Gray Maggiano, who is the rector of Memorial Episcopal Church. And they are doing this event that we talked about on Sunday about the 1619 Project. But they're also undergoing a self-examination of the origins of that congregation. The memorial is a memorial to a man who owned slaves, and they're actually thinking about changing the name of the church because of that. And they're wrestling with the distinction between atonement and apology.
And erasure. And it's even more complex. It's easier when you're talking about monuments, although I think I think we should have, and I said it at the time, we should have kept the monuments up and said the truth about what these people were. And some people said, and this is important, that that was impossible, that you could not have a statue that inherently honored somebody, even if we told the truth. I think when you're talking about a church, which of course strives to inspire morality at the highest level, that makes the argument of keeping the name much more difficult.
They have signage, which lists the names of enslaved people who were connected to the congregation through the people who owned them. And they are going through this whole notion or this discussion, a communal discussion, evidently. And I want to talk to Gray about this at some point when we have a chance. That there is a difference between atonement and apology. That apology is outward, saying I'm sorry to you for the ills that have been befallen African Americans, but atonement is more inward looking, and I mean, and this is as explained to me by Linda Riddleman. I'm interested in that. That atonement is saying this is my problem. This is, you know, my bad, you know, and that is a different experience.
I think
than
both
apologizing.
Both are necessary. I have the unusual, my family has the unusual experience of having been apologized to by the white family from which I am partially descended. There is a small plantation museum in Western North Carolina, and not the ladies who give the candlelight dinners, but the family itself has acknowledged after we showed up and apologized, overtly apologized. That's very important to me.
So it's got to be both.
I think so.
Yeah. There's a guy named Damon Linker who wrote in an op-ed for The Week. He's another conservative columnist. He said that the 1619 Project is reframing American history. And it's saying this, telling this history in a highly sensationalistic, reductionist, and tendentious way.
I think it'd be hard to accuse the New York Times of being sensationalistic. And I mean, if this were the National Enquirer, which they would never do this story. I think it, in the confines of a newspaper as opposed to, you know, an encyclopedia, they've been as thoughtful as they usually are.
What do you take of the... what do you make of their handling of things? I've heard a critique that I've actually even heard from people on the left that says, you know, relating everything to slavery is a mistake. There's one of the articles that talks about how traffic jams and the fact that we have, you know, such horrible traffic in so many different cities, Atlanta, Washington, et cetera, Baltimore. That relating that to slavery is just, that's just too far flung.
Oh, and we have streets here in and around Baltimore that they basically just paved the roads that slaves took the tobacco to the harbor. I think it is wrong to suggest that people are saying that every tiny little thing in American culture is related to slavery. I do think it is important work to ferret out and document and follow those many, many things that are.
Folks on the left, back in the day when the right used to condemn communism and the Russian menace, when they lost the Russian menace, when the Soviet Union was broken up, then they moved to culture stuff, you know, Mapplethorpe and all that kind of stuff. Newt Gingrich goes on Fox and Friends a week or so ago and says that this is the new model for the left. We're now, the next 2 years are going to be Trump and racism because the left lost the Mueller argument. Mueller didn't deliver the goods on Russian collusion, so they've just moved to the next thing, and the next thing is going to be Trump and how he's a racist.
I think that overestimates Trump's role in all of this. This was a train that had started moving before his election.
Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. That's all the time we have. It's always good to see you, and we'll see you next time.
Good to see you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's another edition of Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're going to talk about the ethics around the high cost of life-saving medication. So that's on deck tomorrow here on Midday. And on Thursday, a reminder that we'll broadcast Midday live from the Enoch Pratt Central Library. Pratt CEO Heidi Daniel and others will join us to talk about all the great stuff going on at the Pratt now that the $115 million renovation is complete. You are welcome to join us in the audience for this event at the Pratt. You can come to WIPR.org to reserve a free ticket. Want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. Menu and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up next after news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR.